Hi, this is Josh Kirby, the co-founder and chief product officer of Kinslips, and you're listening to Professionally Cannabis.
Where do they go? The smoke rings I blow each night.
Oh, today on the pod, we're joined by Josh Kirby, founder and chief product officer at Kinslips, an organization at the forefront of the sublingual strip cannabis products industry. With the efficacy of different delivery mechanisms often hotly debated, both for recreational and medical cannabis products, we are keen to get under the bonnet, or perhaps in this case, under the tongue, of the science behind the business and how Kinslips are reaching consumers across North America. So with that in mind, Josh, welcome to the Professionally Cannabis Podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Josh, welcome to the podcast. So our first question is, what led you to the plant?
That's a great question. So I actually grew up in a very rural part of New York State. And where I grew up, I don't know if you had this where you're from, but we had this program called DARE that was basically a way to scare elementary school kids into not taking drugs by giving them a ton of misleading information about cannabis and all kinds of stuff. And it was just complete fear-mongering from the government into our schools, which is great. And so I grew up with a really, really kind of warped view on the uses of cannabis, the dangers of cannabis. And so I didn't touch it all throughout my youth. The first time that I actually used cannabis was with a group of friends in college. And I had that kind of stereotypical first cannabis use moment where, you know, I hit from this really weird bong. I had no idea what I was doing. I was coughing like crazy. And then, like, through my giggling tears, muttered the words, "Why is this illegal? I don't get it." So that was my first experience with cannabis. And then from then on, you know, I had kind of been moving more and more towards acceptance of the plant and use of the plant and finding different ways to kind of work it into my lifestyle. And eventually I ended up working with a group of people that were exploring different entrepreneurial opportunities. And one of the things that they were looking at was different industries where technologies or laws were changing really, really rapidly, and looking at what kind of business opportunities existed there. And one of my tasks was to explore the burgeoning cannabis industry. This was right around 2012, 2013-ish. And so I started doing some research into what was going on in Colorado and in Washington, and I got really, really fascinated by what was happening. And I decided to actually move from where I was in New York at the time to Seattle to try to get directly involved with the cannabis industry. One of the things that really happens when you start to get involved with cannabis is, regardless of what your intentions are coming into the industry, you know, whether you're doing it to help a friend or a family member who has a condition, or you're using it as an entrepreneurial opportunity, the first thing that happens is you start to get your product out to people, and you immediately start to get this amazing feedback about the impact that it's having on people's lives. And that's really, that was the moment that really kind of cauterized my involvement in the cannabis industry, was, you know, making something in my house just to try to see if I could get a product off the ground, and then immediately just having this amazing feedback of this thing fundamentally impacted the quality of my life, you know, and that's just a really powerful moment that really kind of kept me around.
And what were those early products? How do they compare to what you've got going on now?
So the first product that I ever made was in college, and this was before I was trying to like make a product. And it was a brownie. I tried to make brownies for my friends, and I way overdosed them, and everybody got way more stoned.
A completely unique experience, I'm sure.
Yeah, exactly. So I kind of, you know, put my infusion hat aside for a little while, and then when I moved out to Seattle, the first product that we started to try to make was a gum. We really wanted to make something that was kind of consumer friendly, that people would recognize and be able to use, and also that didn't have this association with kind of, you know, quote unquote, the illicit cannabis market. You know, when you see brownies and when you see cookies and granola bars, those things kind of evoke a form of cannabis consumption, or at least an era of cannabis consumption that we felt strongly we needed to move away from. Because one of the things we saw was, you know, you could go into a dispensary where there would be cancer patients looking to treat, you know, their nausea or their pain or, you know, real serious conditions. And the only thing that wasn't smoking that was available to them was like a brownie wrapped in saran wrap with Sharpie written on it. And so we really wanted to kind of bridge that gap and bring a more consumer-friendly product into the market that was trustworthy and then looked reliable and was packaged nice. So we tried to make a gum. That was like the first thing that I wanted to do. So I did a bunch of research on how you make gum. I did a bunch of research on the ingredient sourcing, the equipment that you need. And I got a little kit together and started, you know, producing like these very, very small batches of infused gum in my kitchen and started trying them out. And what I quickly realized was that gum doesn't actually... It's pretty easy to get cannabis into gum. It's pretty easy to get cannabis into just about anything. But it's not that easy to get the gum to release the cannabis. And so after playing with it for a little while, we kind of realized that just shoving weed into gum isn't going to do anything. It just stays stuck in there. And so what we really needed to do, or what my idea was to kind of build like a candy shell on the gum, like you would see in like a chiclet or something, and then put all the cannabis in there. That way, when you bite it, that dissolves, goes into your mouth, and then you can just spit the gum out whenever you're done with the gum. I never figured out how to make those candy shells. They're super, super hard to make. Despite my best efforts, I couldn't figure it out, but I did accidentally make this really thin, kind of fast dissolving candy. And that was kind of the spark of, oh, this should really be the product. We should really try to focus on this really discreet, really minimal dissolving strip product. And so the initial product we had was this very, very crude dissolvable strip. It would like kind of crumble apart in the packaging, but it worked. You know, I was able to like get a strip with cannabis in it and get it to people in it, and it was actually really, really effective. So despite it being kind of a very crude version of it, we just kept developing it and developing it and developing it. And now we're probably like 7 or 8 years later in the development of this form factor. And it's a pretty huge jump. Now, when you look at one of our products, it's more or less indistinguishable from one of those Listerine strips. It holds together really well, tastes really great, dissolves really nicely. So yeah, we've come a long way from our failed attempt at gum and candy coatings.
I tell you what, I was actually quite a big fan of those Listerine type strips. They sort of debuted in the UK a number of years ago and mm-hmm. had about sort of 4 months until they were pretty hard to find again and then sort of went away. But something about that mechanism was really fascinating to me. Now, as far as cannabis products go, what can you tell us about the sort of the science behind sublingual delivery devices?
So the way that sublingual cannabis products work is they take advantage of a natural pathway that exists in your mouth that connects the inside of your mouth directly to your bloodstream. So if you think about the way that like an oral cannabis product works, like a capsule or a gummy or a brownie or something like that, you're swallowing that and then your digestive system is essentially extracting the cannabis out of that product and then moving it into your bloodstream. And that process takes a little while. That's why it takes about an hour for things to kick in. And through that process, a lot can happen to the cannabis that's in there, which is why you can get varying degrees of effects from the same types of products on repeated use. But what's great about sublingual absorption is all that happens is you are just kind of allowing the active ingredient, whatever it is, cannabis, terpenes, you know, other sort of nutraceutical products, or even the pharmaceutical industry uses this for certain drugs. You set it on top of what's called your oral mucosa, which is basically that little squishy spot underneath your tongue. And that allows the active ingredient to get pulled directly through the capillaries in that membrane right into your bloodstream. So you have a much more direct mode of action. It gets to the part of your body that actually is utilizing the active ingredient a lot faster. And you don't have to deal with what's known as first pass metabolism, which is that sort of distortion of the active ingredient that happens through the digestive system. So the major advantages are obviously time to onset, because it doesn't have to go through all of that machinery, and it kind of goes directly in. You get the effects within about 10 minutes or so, depending on how the product's formulated and exactly what you're taking. It is more efficient, but it is a little complicated, because one of the things that happens when you take an oral cannabis product, specifically when you're taking THC-based oral cannabis products, is the standard form of orally ingested THC is a molecule called delta-9 THC. And that's the same molecule that you get when you smoke or vape. And that's what we put into our strips as well. When you consume that orally, what happens is through your stomach acids and then further in your liver through the enzymes in your liver that process drugs and toxic substances, that delta-9 THC is partially and somewhat randomly converted into another molecule called OH-11 THC. And that molecule is much, much more psychoactive. But the conversion from delta-9 to delta-11 is really, really hard to predict because it depends on all kinds of stuff, from what you ate that day to how much exercise you get to your own, specific biochemistry to maybe what the pH balance in your gut is at the time. So there's no way to really predict how much more of that more psychoactive stuff you're going to get. But when you take something sublingually, you completely bypass that system. And so it goes directly into your bloodstream as delta-9 THC. So you do get a much more efficient delivery of the product, and you also get a much more consistent experience. And that experience tends to not feel like that kind of logy edible experience you'll get. It feels a lot more like the smoking or vaping experience that a lot of people are looking for.
Yeah, and I think the experience point is one that's probably a big driver on these. I know here in the UK, my grandma, for instance, would love to be able to get a THC oral medicine that doesn't require eating something that feels like a sweet or a candy or something unhealthy, but in fact is a much more medicalized and specific. But getting away mm-hmm. from the product for a bit, although perhaps we'll come back to it and talk about some of the range, what's the business environment that you're operating in like in 2021? Because I think you're just in California right now, the most competitive cannabis marketplace in the world. What's the news from the front line?
It's really it's interesting. So we're in California. That's where our home base is. That's where we launched Kinslips as a brand and as a company in 2016. But we're also we actually recently just launched in Canada as well. So we have our product in the international market, which is really exciting. We partnered with a company up there called Aleafia Health to launch Kinslips in Canada. So that's very, very exciting. But as it relates to California, you know, the business environment is beginning to stabilize. There's a lot of really good things that are starting to happen, but it is still very, very young. So we've dealt with a number of challenges over the last several years as we've gone from the medicinal sort of gray market to the fully legal, fully adult use, fully regulated market. And that transition was very, very rocky. We had gone through the same thing through a previous business in Seattle. We had taken another company through the medical market into the adult use market. And so we kind of thought that, you know, hey, we've seen this movie before. We know exactly how this is going to go. We're going to have such a huge advantage coming into the California market. And we were just completely unprepared for how just bonkers it was going to be. The big challenge that you have in California is that you have three different regulatory agencies that they sort of work together, but they sort of don't work together, that are regulating different parts of the cannabis industry. So you have the CDTFA, which is the agricultural regulator. They regulate the growers. And then you have the CDPH, which regulates all the infused products manufacturing. That's like the health department. They regulate like food and stuff. And then you have the BCC, which is the Bureau of Cannabis Control. And they regulate like cannabis distributors and cannabis retailers. And everything needs to flow through one contiguous system through all these different business types and all these different regulators. And it just creates a massive amount of confusion because they all have their own regulations. Some of the regulations are kind of conflict with each other. So you're never really sure what exactly you're supposed to do. Thankfully, they're starting to combine these agencies together, and we're going to have one regulatory agency that covers the entire cannabis industry, which is really great. But I think that process is probably also going to be a little messy and going to have a little bit of change. But this is kind of just what happens with a newly regulated industry, especially one where you are trying to take a set of existing businesses and move them into a regulated market. So one of the interesting things about the way cannabis has become legalized is that nothing like this has ever happened before. You've never had like a $50 billion industry that exists that you're trying to take it from sort of being regulated in this medical market and trying to get everybody to get a license and follow the rules and do all this stuff. And at the same time, as they're regulating these things, there's this kind of inherent especially in America, but I think we've done a really great job of permeating this fear across the world, unfortunately, where there is just a giant misconception about the dangers of cannabis and about the risks of cannabis and about all the bad things that can come along with it. Most of those things are bad because they were illegal, not because the product or the plant itself is inherently dangerous. But because you have all of this kind of built-in fear around the legalization of this product, you end up with a lot of unnecessary rules about how it needs to be regulated to make people feel safe, to make regulators feel safe, to make you know, people who are going to be voting for this, like parents and grandparents, feel safe about, you know, checking yes on the box. And so you end up with an industry that is among the most heavily regulated industries in the entire world. I was saying we have these three different agencies that oversee the kind of different segments in California. Each of those agencies has a set of regulations that is like 350 pages long. And we end up with regulations that are more intense than what you would see on organic foods. We have, in some cases, stricter regulations than are put onto pharmaceutical companies in terms of our testing requirements. So there's a lot that goes into it. For the first couple of years, this was really, really challenging to deal with because it was just like all of this happened at once and they kept changing it every few months. So we ended up in positions where, you know, we would get the new regulations, we would go order all of our packaging, we would print all our packaging, get it in, put a batch out. And then the second we're shipping that packaging, the rules change and instantly we're not allowed to use that packaging anymore. There's one word that needs to change or one, you know, one little paragraph on the back or like one little symbol needs to change. And it just causes a massive, massive amount of confusion. It causes a ton of waste, unfortunately, with having to throw out packaging that's not compliant anymore. But thanks to the really, really hard work of our team and the other people in the industry that we console with and consult with on these things, we've been able to get through the bulk of that. And we're now in a much more stable regulatory environment. They haven't changed the rules in about a year, and there's no sense that there's going to be any major changes coming up, especially on the like packaging and product side, which is why I'm very, very grateful for that. And so now we get to do the work of kind of building the actual foundation of the industry. So the next thing that really needs to happen in California is we need to get a lot more licensed retailers. There's kind of this sense, I think, from people who might not be in California, that California is a kind of sprawling oasis of just pot shops. And at one point that was kind of true, like in the medical days when you didn't have to have licenses, you didn't have to pay all these fees, you didn't have to pay all these taxes. You could just start a cannabis store, a medical cannabis store, with nothing as long as you had a space to do it. And you could do pretty well for yourself without a ton of infrastructure. And now that's just not the case. And because of this, we are in a situation where there's about 600 or so licensed retailers throughout the entire state of California, which might sound like a lot. And for a state that isn't California, that might be. But if you compare it to a similar industry and you look at the amount of just liquor stores, not even other alcohol just distribution points in California, just liquor stores, there's about 10,000 liquor stores in California. So just to put that in perspective, there are so few outlets to get the product through, to get them to people in California, that it is really, really competitive from a brand perspective. So if you're in a category like, you know, gummies, or you're in a category like vapes, you have a ton of competition because there are so many brands who are trying to do those products, and you're all fighting for shelf space with these 600 stores. Fortunately, we don't really have any competition. Nobody else is making a strip in California right now. So we don't necessarily have to fight for shelf space in that same way, but we do have to kind of fight for mind share a little bit because we're more of a niche product than, say, a vape or a gummy. It's really on us to go in and educate people about what our product is so that they're aware of it. You know, awareness about our product is a huge challenge for us because it's not inherently obvious that a cannabis product that's a strip would exist. And so that's really the biggest challenge for our business, is raising the awareness about our form factor.
And you mentioned about competition there. And as I understand, well, if I understand right, a while back, you guys actually merged with another company, Olo. Now, I know for a lot of folks in this space, often when we're hearing about M&A, it is sort of multi-billion pound or billion-dollar deals with sort of the big LPs. But I guess in terms of understanding how these things work, we often don't hear about the sort of the normal mergers and acquisitions right. that must happen all the time. I'd love, if possible, if you could give us a little bit of insight as to how that works and how that sort of worked for you guys. Sort of, how did the merger come about? Who courted who? And how does something like that operationally work? And how do you manage that as a business leader and founder?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, this merger in particular, this is actually the first merger that I have ever personally been a part of, and I didn't do a lot of the kind of actual navigating of it. That all the credit for getting us through this goes to my business partner Ron, who's one of the co-founders of the company. But basically, what happened was we had been kind of chugging along, building our company, and we were getting to a point where we were ready to kind of make a bigger entrance into the marketplace. We were gearing up for this kind of this big new thing that we were working on. And then COVID-19 unfortunately hit and the entire Bay Area got locked down. And we were kind of put in a position where we had to figure out how we were going to pivot as a business to stay alive. We couldn't just sit there and be closed. We would have just run out of money. And we would then the business would have gone to zero, which was not obviously something we wanted to do. Fortunately, during this time, we had started building a relationship with this company, Olo, that you mentioned, and the founders and the executives of Olo. And one of the reasons that we wanted to build the relationship with them, the intention wasn't really to merge in the beginning. It was just, let's try to be, there's only one other company that's doing what we're doing. The market, we think, can be really big and support more than just two companies. So instead of, you know, just trying to be callous and competitive with each other, let's see if we can work together to build a mutual awareness of sublingual strips and get this technology out in a bigger way and maybe, you know, come up with some consistencies with how we talk about the product, how we talk about the benefits, and that way we have a better chance of reaching more people and kind of, you know, a rising tide lifts all boats kind of concept. So we had fortunately had developed this relationship when this had happened, when the COVID-19 lockdowns hit. And they were going through a pretty similar thing where they were needing to make a decision about what they wanted to do as a company as well. And we kind of really quickly realized that we had two values in our different organizations that fit together really nicely. So one of the things that we had been really successful in was building a brand and building a pretty decent recurring amount of sales for Kinslips. So a lot of people knew who we were fairly well known in the industry, and we had locked up a few pretty major accounts throughout the state. But one of the things that we struggled with was we had never been a very well-capitalized company. We never had like millions of dollars in the bank account. We were always kind of trying to scrape things together and do things in the scrappiest, most efficient way possible. And because of that, our production process for making these strips wasn't the typical production process. It worked really, really well, and we were able to do some pretty impressive things with it. But it had some limitations in that it was at best a semi-manual process, and a lot of the processes within it were completely manual. So there was one point, for example, where, you know, all of our strips come in a little pouch to protect them from the environment and to keep them from melting and getting ruined in the package. And for a long time, we didn't have a machine to put the strips in the pouch. So we just had basically an army of people who would sit around a table and take strips all day and put them hand into these pouches, right? And so we had this issue where we basically had a scaling issue on the manufacturing side, and we could solve it with a lot of money, but we didn't have a lot of money. The Olo, they had sort of a different problem. So they had taken the approach of building out a automated manufacturing system first that could really, really scale really rapidly. But they had struggled to kind of gain market share within the California market. And so we saw this opportunity really quickly. Fortunately, we both saw it. And so it was a pretty easy thing to navigate. But they had the equipment, they had the facility, they had the infrastructure, and we had the brand and we had the sales. So it made perfect sense for us to come together and kind of put the two organizations together. And I've heard, so one of the things that I hear about when I talk about this merger a lot is like, you know, everyone always wants to know the gossip, right? Of like, oh, well, what's going on with the executive team? There's always got to be some like, who's butting heads with who? What's going on? Is there drama? Right, exactly. And fortunately for this merger, there was absolutely none of that. Everybody came together with the exact same goal in mind and was really focused on how can we most efficiently put these two companies together? How can we make this the absolute most efficient operation possible and really leverage the two things that we have here, which is the Kinslips brand and the Olo manufacturing line. And then it was just a matter of supporting each other through that. So we had kind of there was a bit of a shakeup on the executive team, but it was a really easy process. So before this, I was actually the chief executive officer of the company. And then through the merger, I took on this new role as chief product officer, and Andrew Lobo from Olo, he became the chief executive officer of the new combined company. And so there was a little bit of an adjustment, a little bit of a change, but everyone has been completely supportive of everybody else getting up to speed. And we were able to go from basically not having anything going for us to having completed this merger and shipping new product within a matter of a couple months, all because we were able to kind of, you know, just work together and make it happen.
So what do you see as the future for this space? I assume it will probably track to edibles, but I know you've got some CBN products, you've got a CBD product, you've got two different types of THC. Where is this space going?
So that's a really interesting question, because I think it kind of aligns with where the whole cannabis industry is going. We think that what we have developed is a drug delivery platform. So we have created a way to deliver certain types of drugs. This doesn't work for everything, but certain types of drugs like cannabis and like some nutraceuticals very, very efficiently through this strip. And what we can now do with that knowledge and with this platform is we can start putting whatever we want into it within reason. And so one of the big pushes that we're doing now that we have kind of moved past the combination stage of the merger and we're now more in an operating rhythm, is I've switched my focus to focusing really on R&D for getting new products out into the market. And what I'm really looking at most intensely right now are two key areas. One is the use of kind of strain-based products and finding ways to, while staying faithful to the plant, take and capture an entire strain and put that into a strip, right? So that's one of the areas that we're really trying to focus on, is how can we expand from being a product that caters more towards the kind of new cannabis consumer, someone who is maybe canna curious and someone who is more on the wellness side. How can we now start to reach the other side of the cannabis market, which is really more interested in what kind of cool strains are out there, what kind of varying kind of psychoactive and recreational effects can we get out of the product? So that's one area we're starting to explore pretty heavily. And then the other area that I'm really, really interested in is the emergence of these minor cannabinoids and these different combinations of terpenes, terpenoids, flavonoids, other things that you can put together to create kind of unique and specific effect profiles. So like you mentioned, we have a product with CBN in it, which was our first entrance into the category of minor cannabinoids. And when I say that, I mean cannabinoids outside of THC and CBD specifically. And that product did really, really well. We were really surprised. It actually became our best-selling product within 2 months after we launched it, which was great and really kind of proved that there is a market out there for people who are looking for relief beyond what THC and CBD can offer. And so we're really focused right now on trying to discover what new minor cannabinoids are out there and that will be available within the supply chain soon. You know, it's one thing to say, I want to have a THCV product because everybody's talking about THCV. It's another thing to find enough THCV to put into a product, right? Because the supply chain is very tricky in cannabis. And then the other side of that is really important to me is making sure that whatever we launch as a product, it has a novel use that we've been able to at least on a small scale, validate the effectiveness of. So one of the things we want to stay away from, and one of the things that unfortunately I think happens a lot in the cannabis industry, is people get excited about sort of reported anecdotal effects from products. Like there was this concept that THCV would be like kind of like skinny girl weed, you know, where it would be an appetite suppressant and, you know, help you stop eating and it'd be the anti-munchy weed. there's no evidence that that's true. And nobody that I've talked to who I've given a THCV product to or who's taken THCV products in the past has ever said, yeah, I didn't feel hungry, or I felt specifically less hungry, or that was an effect that I felt at all. So we're trying to be very careful about putting something out there that is in any way misleading. And so it just takes a lot of kind of trial and error to see, okay, we have this compound. Okay, we can get this compound and we can put it into a strip. Now, what does it do? Like, what is the actual usefulness of this molecule? And once we know what that usefulness is and the use case for that product is, how do we enhance that? So at that point, we can then figure out, okay, so maybe we want to use CBG as an anti-inflammatory. Okay, let's figure out what other terpenes and flavonoids and other compounds that are already in cannabis, which of those are strong anti-inflammatories as well, and let's try to combine those all together to make it super, super effective. So that's really what we're focused on in terms of product development for our platform. We think we're uniquely positioned to be able to deliver on products like that because of the absorption nature of our product. It does a really great job of delivering these kind of more delicate molecules like terpenes, and also ensuring that you get the full effect of these minor cannabinoids. And I think that's where the industry is going too. You're starting to see a lot more blended products come out. You're starting to see a lot more interesting ratioed products come out. And people are really finally starting to talk about terpenes in a more mainstream way. So I really think that's where not only the strip category is going, but the cannabis market is going more broadly.
What is the feel of a California cannabis consumer now? Because I think it must be very varied and have a lot more people like my mum than, say, my friends, which is probably how the media might imagine it being the other way.
Yeah. Well, it's really interesting because cannabis is one of those things that is not very demographically selective. In other words, it's not like most cannabis users are, 20, 30 somethings who are, smoking joints. It's really like everybody, every demographic you can imagine, like 20% of them use cannabis, right? And so what we're really seeing in California is a big shift from a lot of people who had been using cannabis in private or kind of sneakily are kind of starting to do it more like they would consumption of alcohol. Maybe they're posting about it more on the internet. Maybe they're more comfortable talking to their friends and family about it. Maybe they're even, totally fine being seen walking in and out of a dispensary, which in the past, the stigma around cannabis was something that was that would prevent a lot of those activities. But the stigma generally is lifting off of cannabis. It's not completely gone. It's not like everywhere you go, everyone's totally accepting of cannabis throughout California. You'll still, find landlords who will put absolutely no cannabis users in the listing of their, apartments when they're looking for new tenants. But despite that, you are starting to see a lot more people come into the space as well. So you are seeing a lot of older cannabis consumers, like moms and grandmas who would not have used cannabis in the past, now are finding novel uses of it. And part of that is the products that are available. But another part of it is just that, people they trust and people they know and people they respect have told them that this thing that you're always complaining about or this thing that you're trying to solve, you might be able to deal with that using a particular cannabis product. And so you're starting to see the stigma slowly kind of melt away, which is really, really exciting. You're also kind of seeing somewhat of a backlash to the mainstreaming of it, particularly from the people who had been in the medical cannabis community and were very solely focused on compassionate cannabis giving. That community has been has not been treated particularly well by the legalization movement, not necessarily purposefully or actively, but just by the nature of the way that these regulations have rolled out, it has prevented a lot of people who were, maybe they had a greenhouse and a medical card and they would go give a ton of cannabis to, veterans or people with PTSD or people who are dealing with intractable pain. And the new regulations really prevent a lot of that compassionate giving, which is very unfortunate. And so there is some pushback that you see from people who are in that community who now the thing that gave meaning to their lives is now almost more illegal, that cannabis is legalized. So that is an unfortunate development that's been happening. There's a lot of people who are working to fix that, and some progress is being made, but that is just something that it happened both in Washington state when that state went from medicinal to adult use, and it happened in California. I imagine it's something that's going to happen anywhere that has a longstanding medical cannabis community. But yeah, overall, it's definitely becoming more acceptable. It's something that you can talk about. And one of the things that I find really interesting is when I first got into cannabis, it was the only thing people wanted to talk to me about. Like, you know, 6 years ago, 7 years ago, I would go to a party and someone would find out I was in cannabis and I would get like cornered in the room and they would be asking me a million questions about it. Everybody instantly assumes you're like a crazy rich drug dealer and they want to know like everything about what's going on in your life and all that stuff. Now people are
They've
pretty bored with
brownies.
It. Yeah, exactly. And now, you know, now it's just more common. You know, you meet people in cannabis all the time. It's like meeting in the Bay Area, especially, it's like meeting somebody who works at a tech company, and you know? It's like, okay, they're a cannabis guy. So the like new exciting part of it is definitely starting to wane, which is good because we can get all of that kind of like ego out of the way and start, you know, building a real industry and you know, building something really meaningful and lasting. But it is just an interesting cultural shift that is going on. I don't think that in terms of, especially in California, in terms of the way people viewed cannabis, there isn't a lot that's changed. There's some research that has been showing that people who were very against cannabis before and never would have ever thought about using it are becoming more open to the idea of at least being okay with other people using it and maybe even wanting to try it themselves. That's kind of a long road that's going to happen, and we're never going to get everybody fully accepting of cannabis. That's just not realistic. You can't get everybody fully accepting of everything or of anything, but yeah, we are starting to see a pretty interesting cultural shift happen.
Excellent. Well, I just want to say you've been a wonderful guest, so thank you very much for joining us here today, Josh.
Thank you so much for having me. This was a blast.
Please take me above, take me with you.